Joining us on Perspectives today is Sarah Heppola. Sarah is currently the personal essays editor at Salon.com, where she reads people's secrets for a living. She has written many stories about drinking and eating too much. Her articles have appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The New Republic, Glamour, The Garden, Nerve, Slate, and Morning News. But most importantly now, she has come out with a novel, and it's called Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. Sarah, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Thank you.
Now, tell us a little bit about, a lot of people will say, well, you know, some people, yes, have drinking problems. And other people say, well, you know, I'm a social drinker. But being an alcoholic is a label that is attached to somebody, kind of like he's a drug addict.
And
we get all the big negative things about that, not knowing that, you know, some of these people can get help and be helped, and perhaps they're doing it to get attention. You started out, well, first of all, if you wouldn't mind sharing with us a little bit about growing up, because you eventually, when you were very young, your father, your family moved to Dallas, Texas, correct?
Yes, I was about 3 and a half when we moved to Dallas, and we were East Coast people, so we were really outsiders. I mean, we were coming into Texas. Nobody in the extended family had ever lived there. It was completely foreign territory, unknown territory to us. And, you know, you were asking me a little bit about my early years of drinking, and one of the funny things about me is that I loved the taste of beer from a very early age. Like, it had a firecracker in my blood kind of sensation for me. I took a sip when I was about 4 or 5 years old. My dad, like, you know, gave me a sip of his beer, and kids are supposed to be like, oh, that's disgusting. And I was like, whoa, I want more of that. And so I started to steal beer from the refrigerator. And, you know, this tells you my mom was such a non-alcoholic that she would leave half cans of beer in the refrigerator, a Pearl Light. San Antonio, Texas. And she would leave it in the fridge. And I had learned that I could sip from it and nobody would notice. I mean, I think little kids are always trying to push the envelope. What can I get away with? What, you know, how much can I, you know, do without people noticing? And my venue just seemed to be that I was really drawn to beer. And I think that is just, I think that that's a genetic deal. You know, I'm Irish and Finnish by heritage. Those are both really strong drinking cultures. And some of us, we just have this stuff on our DNA. You know, you are born into a body that craves that kind of taste, right?
Yes.
And so I have to say, you know, you were talking about the difference between being a drinker and being an alcoholic. Well, for many, many years, for decades, I really prided myself on being a drinker. That was an identity that I loved. And I, you know, when I was a teenager, I kind of got off on the idea that, like, I could hold my liquor. It was like this tough thing that I could do as a girl. And it was also this thing that I did that made me feel a little superior to my classmates around me who were a little bit more conservative, a little bit more stuffy. And it was like, you guys are so square. You know, I'm a cool kid, even though in truth, I was not a cool kid. I mean, I was a straight A student and I was pretty shy and I was pretty conformist in a lot of ways, but I had this kind of secret rebellion that made me feel good about myself, made me feel different. So I was very proud of being a drinker, but you could not be an alcoholic. It's very funny because when you're a drinker, you're just like, you love being a drinker, but any suggestion that you're an alcoholic is like, oh, no, because that means you have to quit. And so you always want to stay on that cool drinker side. And I think all through my high school years and into my college years, I presented and I appeared to other people to be a heavy binge drinker, a social drinker. And because it's really a rite of passage in American life, this heavy drinking phase, even though I had what you would look back and say, oh, those are kind of red flags for alcoholism. The truth is everybody around me kind of had red flags for alcoholism because there's a certain life passage, which is, you know, you're experimenting with how much drinking you can manage. Like when we were in college and when I was in my early 20s, it was very regular for me and my friends to go out drinking to the point where somebody was puking, somebody was passed out on the couch. You know, people did stupid things. We were all kind of making fools of ourselves. And that was like the great fun of it. Now, one of the things that happened to me that was different than my friends was that I had blackouts. And blackouts, you know, that's the name of the book, is Blackout, because it became kind of significant in my drinking life. But a blackout, I want to explain for anybody that might not understand. A blackout is when you drink so much that your long-term memory shuts down. It's different than passing out, which is when you're just sort of snoring on a couch. So in a blackout, you can be walking and talking to people and interacting with them, but later you won't have any memory of them, any memory of the activity. It's kind of a self-imposed amnesia. So this would happen to me, and I would wake up the next day, and I wouldn't remember how we got home or maybe what I had done. And friends would say to me, oh, do you remember when we did this? And it was like, no, I don't remember. And sometimes it was funny and sometimes it was no big deal. But over time, it became incredibly stressful and freaky to have done things in the world and to have not known what they were.
We are visiting with Sara Hepola. She is the author of the New York Times best-selling book, Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. Sara, when you mentioned earlier about your mom being a kind of like non-drinker because she would leave cans of beer open there, you also mentioned in the book that she would put kind of something like a lemon or orange wedge on it, and you knew exactly how to take that sip and put it back together.
Yeah, I kind of fetishized that moment. I mean, I think we all have these memories from childhood that are just so rich with texture. At least I know I do. And I just remember the ritual of getting that can out of the fridge. And we had these little plastic lime wedges, which I don't know if you remember, but they were like these products that you would put in your soda cans to keep the carbonation from going out. And it didn't really work, but but you would try them anyway. And so I would pop that out, and I would take the first two, you know, I would take like one sip, then maybe two sips. And as I got older, it was kind of like four sips and seven sips. And then I would realize, oh, I can't, this is too much. I got to drink another beer to this level and then hide this beer can. Like, you know, you keep pushing the envelope, right? But then you remember exactly how the beer was in the fridge, and you tilt it just the right way. I mean, listen, the attention to detail that kids have when they're trying to get away with something is just massive. And for whatever reason, like, my memory, I can remember these moments with such precision. It's crazy to me because, you know, there's a lot of stuff in my past I don't remember at all. You know, I have huge chunks of time. But those little memories, they feel kind of burned on my brain.
We're visiting with Sara Hepola. She is the author of the New York Times best-selling book, Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. When you mentioned it was a surprise, I guess, to you and everybody else that you actually liked the taste of beer, because I remember also taking the taste, and I don't like the way it tastes, and I don't drink, but I have friends who do, and as you mentioned, some people, they get a kick out of, I guess, or trying to be accepted into a social group by drinking a lot and being funny so that they can be accepted into a certain group. And I wondered about, when I was reading your book, the fact that when you moved to Dallas, Dallas has some pretty high caliber people there. As far as not just name and society, but also wealth. There are a lot of rich people in Dallas. And so I was wondering, how did you adjust to all that?
You know, it's really hard. I think being an outsider anywhere, you can carry your feeling of being an outsider anywhere you go in the world. But I'll tell you what, it feels pretty acute in Dallas, Texas in the 80s. You know, like, it was a very, at that time especially, a lot of the things that we associate with Dallas, the status seeking and the affluence, they were amplified during that decade. They were amplified everywhere. And I was living in a pretty elite community. We were a middle-class family. My dad worked for the government. My mom was going back to school, and she was trying to become a child therapist. We just didn't have that kind of money. My feeling of estrangement was so intense. And I think it would have been intense anywhere I was because of my genetic makeup. You know, I was shy. I was bookish. I really struggled with self-consciousness to a tremendous degree. You know, it's kind of like that taste for beer. Some people have it and some people don't. Well, in the same way, some kids just seem comfortable in their skin and some people don't. And I was a kid who didn't. And once I had that sip of beer and once I got drunk for the first time, you know, what I was describing to you before, those were just sort of like things, private rituals I had with myself. But when I was 11 years old, I got drunk for the first time. And the feeling of freedom and belonging that I had was such incredible bliss. I felt like I've been searching for that feeling my whole life. It was really intense for me. And it was exactly what you say. It was that feeling of belonging that I wanted. And I think, you know, once you feel that, man, you just go back to that source again and again, because I knew it could give it to me. And I do think that one of the gifts as a young person that drinking gave me, because later it gave me a lot of curses, but I have to remember that the good parts as well, just like any relationship that ends on the outs, you have beautiful times too, or you wouldn't have fallen in love. Well, the beautiful times were when I was sitting around with people that I thought were different than me, better than me, and they would drink, and I would drink, and our barriers would lower, and we would start to tell each other the truth about our lives. And they would say to me, oh, man, I have the worst time at home, or my mom doesn't love me, or I hate my body, or all these things that I thought, oh, I didn't know they were dealing with that. I had no idea. You know, as people, we go around judging each other by our outside. Oh, they look like they're happy. You go on Facebook, everybody looks so happy, and you don't know what kind of private miseries are dwelling there. To me, it felt like alcohol gave me access to that. It also gave me access to a feeling of belonging that I had wanted all my life.
We're visiting with New York Times bestselling author Sara Heppala. She is the author of the book Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. You also, in your book, I find it very interesting when you write about, you mentioned rite of passage a little while ago, but there are other things that young men and women go through at home, and it's something that only a mother or a father can deal with, perhaps like showing the son how to shave for the first time. In your case, okay, so I was wondering about the change, what you saw, and was it difficult, harder or easier because of your drinking when your mother asked you or told you that you were going to go out shopping for a brassiere because you were, you know, developing, and also you had your first menstrual period and you wanted to say, like, well, I'll let you explain it because it's a little better. You went through it when your mother saw you on that floor and she saw that you had a stain. Tell us about what happened next.
Well, you know, so I had an early puberty and I got boobs probably around fourth grade. And I was certainly the first girl in class to have that happen to me. I got my period at the very beginning of fifth grade. And I should also mention that I was young for my class. So it felt like a double curse. I was so horrified by this early puberty. I mean, I was genuinely mortified by the fact that it felt like my body was betraying me. I don't think that my feelings about my body had anything to do with my drinking. The only way that they later became intensely tied together, because alcohol was a way for me to feel comfortable in my own skin and for me to feel more comfortable with a body that had always felt out of my control. But in those early years, when I was 9 and 10, and my mother, who, you know, my mother was a flawed mother, like every mother out there, but she definitely veered on the side of super loving. You know, she was really trying to be a different kind of mother than the one that she had had, one that was a little bit more attentive. And she had a daughter that really just, I didn't want any attention to my body. I mean, I really was so horrified by the fact that I was what they call a woman now. Well, I was 9 years old. I didn't want to be a woman now. I wanted to be a kid. And so my need to hide, my desire to hide, was very, very intense. And as I kind of came into my teen years, and especially into my college years when I was dating and when the hookup culture was a little bit more common around me, the alcohol provided this cover, you know, that I could never quite find. It was incredible to me to be able to pop open that drink and take that liquid into my body and feel like I was covered up, even when I was completely, you know, naked. And then the other weird thing was that I was so repressed as a sober person, but the drunker I got, the more I would want to take off my clothes and do things like that. And it was just completely foreign to the way I was when I was sober. But when I got drunk, it was just like, I think my inhibitions went away and I was like, hello world, let me show you what I've got. You know, it was just that really crazy thing of being so different when you're drunk.
We're visiting with New York Times bestselling author Sara Heppala. She is the author of the book Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. Now, in your book, you guide us through your college years also and, you know, journalism, and then your first job where you land in this newsroom, which is, you know, as you mentioned in your book, it's a great thing. And it is a great thing because myself being a journalist also and getting a job right out of college, the fact that one of the magazines that you're working for sends you to Paris, and that's where, I guess, the things start getting pretty heavy.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, I worked in journalism throughout my 20s. And so, you know, all my 20s were kind of, they were a rollicking good time, more or less. I mean, actually, I quit drinking for a year because I kind of felt like, ooh, my drinking's getting out of control. But I got back into the on the party van, and it was a good time. When I was in my 30s, I was living in New York, actually, and I got sent to Paris. And it was a dream of a lifetime. I mean, oh, my gosh. I mean, I'm going on a magazine assignment to Paris, France. This little girl from Dallas, Texas, who felt so small in the world. Like, look at me. I'm living the dream. And I had this per diem, which means they give you money. They gave me free money. And so I go out with a friend. We go to this fancy restaurant. And I'm drinking cognac all night. And I've never drank cognac before. And I'm suddenly like, whoa, I should be drinking this all the time. This is going to be my signature drink. I was so I was in such a state of bliss. And we got home. I was staying at a hotel. My friend peeled off and went home to her place. And I got back to the hotel, and I walked to the front door, and I said hi to the concierge, and then that's the last thing I remember. It was a blackout. And like I said, this was a very common thing for me. It happened quite often, especially when I was drinking liquor, which I certainly was that night. And when I came back into the world, I was in the middle of having sex with someone, and I didn't know who he was. And this had never happened to me before. I mean, I certainly had lost time. You know, I had situations where I remember going to the bar, and I met the guy, and we were talking, and maybe we were kissing. And then I woke up the next morning, and it was like, whoa, there's like a reel of film missing. But nothing like this, where I literally did not know who this person was. I did not know where I was. It was so disorienting, but I was also in this, like, liquor fog, some kind of slowly coming out of it and trying to make sense of the world. You know, I have a line in the book where it's kind of like, you know, you wake up kissing a pillow, but then, like, the pillow turns out to be this guy that you've never met. You know, like, you're just, like, making sense of, like, okay, whoa, how did I get here? And that's the key question that every blackout drinker has to ask. How did I get here? And so I finally make my way out of that hotel room. I figure out I'm in the same hotel that I'm staying in. I make my way out. It's kind of an awkward exchange, but, you know, hey, that happens in a drinking life. And I leave the room, and I'm walking back to my hotel, and I realize I don't have my purse, and I don't know where it is. And when I say that I don't have my purse, I mean, I don't have my passport, I don't have my wallet, I don't have anything. And then I realize I don't know who that person was, and I don't know what room it was, and I don't know what room I just walked out of. And it's this sort of panicked evening that, you know, the whole night kind of unfolds into this, like, dark night of the soul where you're trying to trace this trail of string back to find the thing that you've left. And it really was, you know, the reason that I focus on that story is that to me it felt extremely emblematic of the total chaos that induces when you drink the way that I drank, you know, and this really is what separates the drinker from the alcoholic. You know, there are, at some point, there's no clear litmus test to tell you what makes one or the other. It's really an accumulation of evidence. It's just like any diagnosis, mental diagnosis, just like putting somebody on trial. You're basically going over the evidence here. And what I had that night was very, very strong evidence that the way that I drank was not controllable. I could not manage it. It was too chaotic, and it was much more pain than it was joy.
We're visiting with New York Times bestselling author Sara Heppala. She is talking about her book, Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. At what point, Sara, did you decide, because you know you said that at one point you, before you went to Paris, you had been on the wagon, but then you went off the wagon. But at what point did you decide, you know, I need to do something about this? And not just that, but also the decision to write your book. And I'm wondering if it's where towards the end of the book you mentioned your childhood friend playing an audio tape for you that you had made years earlier. And, you know, in what direction did you go?
You know, I think the question of, like, when I decided to stop is extremely important, but it's also a tricky one. you know, the truth is that I knew I drank differently than other people probably from college because of those blackouts. And it just, the question is, what are you going to do about it? So I quit when I was 25, and then I tried to slow down in my early 30s, and then I changed jobs, and I changed apartments, and I changed habits, and I started doing yoga more, and I did all the things that you cross off the list that can help maybe moderate your drinking, because that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to figure out, can I moderate my drinking? And for me, it was basically an elimination of all those things off the list. I mean, that night happened in Paris, and I knew in my bones, I can't drink anymore. But I drank for 5 more years because I really didn't want to, I didn't want to give that up. And I think this is the truth about humans, is that we don't like change and that we know things in our gut that we have to do. I have to leave that job. I have to leave that marriage. I have to stop eating the Twinkies. But we don't want to do them because change is very hard. So what happened to me is that my life just became so painful that change became the thing that I wanted. You know, the next 5 years are basically a slow circling of the drain. And within that, you know, cool things happened. I got a job. Maybe that'll fix it. I got a nice apartment. Maybe that'll fix it. But none of them fixed it. So when I was 35 years old, I finally got to this place that just felt to me like I was pushed in a corner and I couldn't go anywhere. And I was either, like, I remember this feeling, like, I don't know that I'm going to die. I think I might just live like this. And my life at that point had gotten very small. You know, I was mostly drinking at home because I was getting in trouble when I went out. I was getting confronted by friends. I was broke. I was just this lonely person drinking in her tiny studio apartment in Manhattan. You know, this is living the dream? I don't think so. You know, that was really living a nightmare. And so I think that's when I finally surrendered, although it's always mysterious. You know, for me, I had to quit like 100 times to make the 101st time stick. I mean, I really did quit at least 100 times, you know. Forget this. I'm never doing this again. And then 4 days, I'm like, maybe I'm doing it for a little while. But somehow on the 101st, or who knows, because I wasn't exactly counting, the 196th, it sticks, right? And one of the things that was key for me is that I joined the 12-step program. You know, I joined AA, which is very controversial to talk about, you know, but I've found for me that it's important to be honest about this part of my story because my resistance to AA was so strong that I find it important to tell other people that might be having that kind of resistance, that it worked for me. I also just want to make a quick note here that there are a lot of different ways to get sober, and I don't think any of them are wrong. You know, other people join different kinds of programs. Other people don't need a program. It's just that I did. That particular program for me, it gave me community, and it gave me someone to be accountable to, and it was what I found that could help me out of the hole. The hole that was my total isolation at the point that I quit drinking. You know, you talked a little bit about, you asked me about why I wanted to write the book. And I started writing the book in my first year of sobriety. And again, it wasn't really like a light bulb moment as much as a slow dawning on me that like, oh, this is something I could do that I haven't done in, you know, I never managed to write a book in my drinking. And that was something I always wanted to do. For years, I was your friend at the bar that was going to write a book. Oh, I loved it when people introduced me as like, Sarah, she's going to write a book one day. That's right, you guys. I'm going to write a book. But I could never get it together. And so as I got a little more clarity in my sober life, and I would say it took about 6 months at least to get the clarity to think like, okay, maybe I should try something, try a new challenge. I really thought, like, I want to write a memoir. I want to write a book. You know, when they talk about, you know, there's a saying in the writing world, write what you know. And when I look around, like, what did I know more than anything else? It was drinking. I had a PhD in drinking, an unofficial PhD. I didn't actually go to school
yes,
for it.
Yes, okay.
But so, you know, it became like the next challenge that I could do. And I really wanted to plant a flag in the sand of my sober life and say, like, this is something I couldn't have done when I was drinking. And so the book became kind of a rallying cry in that way. And also, writing a book about your drinking life kind of tracks with the work of sobriety. The work of sobriety is kind of trying to see your life a little more clearly. A lot of us as drinkers tend to romanticize our past, how beautiful it all was, how amazing, how spectacular. But if you peel away the layers, there's a lot of complicated truth in there. For me, one of my huge defense mechanisms was humor. You know, I always wanted to be funny and, you know, how funny and hilarious I was when I was drinking. But the truth was, a lot of it wasn't that funny, and I wasn't that funny. I was really often very sad, and the humor was a defense against it. And the more I started digging into my past, the more I felt like I could understand my drinking better, the reasons why I drank. You know, and that's why I call the book Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget. The things I drank to forget are not just what I did when I was drinking, the shame I felt about that. The things I drank to forget were my human feelings, the feelings that I had in me all along, the ones of insecurity, the ones of self-consciousness, shyness, my discomfort in my own body. That's what I was trying to drink away. And I think in sobriety was when I kind of finally figured out, like, I don't think you get to drink those away. I think they stay with you, and you better reckon with them.
Sara, we are wrapping up the program now, but if you wouldn't mind sharing with us a website that goes to a blog or a Facebook page, whatever, because the fact that this book just shot up in the New York Times bestselling list tells me, I think, that there are a lot of people who can associate or deal with this.
Yeah, I think so, you know, and I think it's, even though it's a book about being a woman who drinks, I hear from just as many men. And honestly, I also hear from people that don't even have drinking problems. They just have maybe, you know, they have difficulties in their own body for whatever reason and have different addictions. But the website is my name, Sara Hepola, SaraHepola.com. And that can bring you to information about the book, more articles that I've written, as well as just, you know, a link to go to if you want to look at more about whether or not you have a drinking problem or not, which I know is a hard question for everybody to answer, for a lot of people to answer.
Well, Sara, we want to thank you very much for taking the time to be with us and also for being so open and transparent, not only in your book, but in this interview as well. Thank you so much for being with us. We've been visiting with New York Times bestselling author Sara Hepola. She has written the book Blackout, Remembering the Things I Drank to Forget.